Welcome to Whistleblower Network News. I am your host, Jane Turner, FBI whistleblower and advocate. It is our honor to share with you these experiences of real-life heroes and people of integrity. Delighted to introduce our audience to Ted Blickwadle, who is going to tell us his story about working in the VA, what he ran up against. And it's an incredible story, so strap in, and here we go. Ted, it is just an honor to have you on Whistleblower of the Week. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Jane. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I want to ask you, before we get into the nuts and bolts of your whistleblowing, and it is an incredible story, so we're going to take off here in a minute. But tell us where you were raised and born and where you're at now in terms of a family, because people are always interested in that, because as you know, whistleblowers are kind of a different cut of cloth. So tell us where you're from.
Well, yes, I grew up in a blue-collar family in Emporia, Pennsylvania, about 100 miles northwest of Harrisburg. And I have two brothers. I've been married for 40 years. And have two stepchildren, and in fact, my stepson also was in the Marine Corps. I'm a retired Marine and combat veteran.
Yes, a lieutenant colonel. That's pretty high up there for people who are not aware. And you are combat and disabled vet.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And prior to working at the vet center as a counselor at the VA, you did receive a BA in psychology and a master's in rehabilitation counseling from Penn State.
Yes.
And then tell us about your active duty. You were active duty, right, with the Marine Corps as a logistics officer.
Yes. And also the last 7 years, I was in also some combat arms billets just by the nature of some of my assignments. But it should be pointed out now, the 27 years that I was in actually the reserve establishment. I started out with 4 years of active duty, went into the reserves, but under the active duty special works program, I did intermittent periods of active duty, you know, a year here, 9 months there, 6 months there, you know, over a 27-year period before I retired in 2006.
And I did mention you were disabled.
Yes.
So were those combat wounds of some sort?
No, it was not combat related, actually. It was exacerbated by some combat related situations, but there were things that were going on during the course of my military service even prior to that.
Gotcha. And you ended up, because you have this fabulous background, you have a master's, of course, in the rehabilitation. You ended up at the Veterans
Center. Right. And so subsequent to my retirement from the Marine Corps, I went back to school, got another master's degree at Rhode Island College in clinical social work. And then in 2009, several months after I had graduated, I started working at the Vet Center in Warwick, Rhode Island, doing individual group therapy with combat veterans.
And you enjoyed that, Ted, didn't you?
It was fabulous.
And you were good at it. And you were good at it.
Absolutely. It was a great fit. I absolutely thoroughly enjoyed it. It was very satisfying and very purposeful.
And the clients really appreciated you, from what I understand.
Oh, yes. I've gotten a lot of great feedback, not just during my time there, but people I run into that are former clients that were, you know, part of veteran service organizations I'm affiliated with. I continue to get all kinds of accolades, and I'm just glad that I was there for them. You know, they needed
yes.
that kind of service.
So, like most whistleblowers, you were doing your job, and you weren't just doing it, you were outstanding at it. And you were trained for it, you had the background for it, the clients were happy with you. And of course, here you are in this stage of your life. And tell us what happened.
Well, so I had been at the Vet Center for 9 years. I started in 2009, as I said. And around 2016, the VA management decided to change their clinical productivity policies on counselors, increasing visit counts and other administrative additions that basically was burning out counselors and impeding our ability to provide quality care to veterans. And it was an ethical decision. Do we provide quality care or try to meet these numbers because of what appeared to be threats of, if you don't meet the numbers with different memorandums that went out, you know, it looked like that there was going to be, you know, HR kinds of actions going on, which obviously when you start lining up those ducks, that's eventually potentially could get someone fired if they're not meeting those metrics. So it became quite an issue for a lot of people, clinicians in the system that, you know, decided that some of them, you know, scared they're going to lose their jobs. Well, I'm going to, you know, meet the numbers. Others said, no, I'm going to do like me. I'm going to provide quality care, whether I meet the numbers or not, to do the right thing by the veterans.
Exactly. And this did not help the veterans, did it? This new kind of ruling that came down to not spend as much time.
I was hearing from when I finally raised the issue nationally to the leadership in Washington with Mike Fisher, who is the RCS chief officer of the Vet Center program, didn't get any response. I even had recommendations and what problems these policies were causing with burnout and, you know, compromising quality mental health care. No response. So after a week, I resent that with amplifying comments. But this time I CC'd all the directors and all the counselors in the system across the country. And then he started to respond inadequately, not just my opinion, but the opinion of others. And before they shut my computer down as a consequence of that, after 48 hours, I actually managed to get 57 responses from 25 counselors. I'm sorry, from 57 counselors across 25 states and 42 different vet centers, which basically validated, you know, the concerns I was raising, and some of it pretty poignantly, you know, that they all were concurrent.
Now, Ted,
causing them, you know, some people were seeking their own therapy because of it. Some people are going on medication because of anxiety and depression they were facing, FMLA leave. A lot of people were going on. Some people said enough is enough. They were taking early retirement, seeking other employment, going into private practice. And it caused, because of all this, quite a high turnover rate, which is still ongoing.
So you saw a problem in the VA. You tried to address it. And I have a feeling something very ugly is going to happen now. But did you know at that time, Ted, that you were being a whistleblower? I mean, you just conducted this research. You found these startling facts that these counselors are just being beaten to death out there in the field. But you had no idea, did you, that you were going to be a whistleblower?
No, I had no idea that that's what I was doing. I know what I know now, looking back, that that's what it was. I was just trying to address an issue, to do the right thing for the right reason because of what was going on. And then when the retaliation started, initially it was shutting down my computer. There's a lot more that happened after that. Then I was beginning to realize the different tactics that were very toxic and malicious that they were doing to try to silence me. And the overall catch in that is to discredit me. They were trying to paint me in various ways as being a mentally unstable combat veteran.
Yes.
And it was absolutely horrific. And so it got to the point where, you know, I'm thinking, this doesn't feel right. Something's going on. And I didn't have any support. I didn't know anything about organizations. That could support you in this. I just sort of stepped off on my own as the lone wolf, so to speak. And I was completely dazzled, you know, by what was going on, and finally realized, you know, this is not right, the way they were gaslighting me with all this. Mm-hmm. It kind of made me wonder. You had me second guessing myself at times. And
yes.
And then along the way, I ran into Jackie Garrick of Whistleblowers of America, who really helped me understand that these are intentional, purposeful tactics that are used against people that speak truth to power. And so I realized, oh my God, well, I'm not alone. This is what's going on. It's not like I'm being singled out per se when this is the kind of thing that happens to anybody that takes this kind of a stand.
Exactly. And, you know, 25 years ago, we didn't have any terms for what you experienced or what we experienced. Fred Whitehurst and I and the FBI,
right.
All those kind of things happening, the mobbing, the counter accusations, you know, gaslighting, you outline them very well. And we had no idea. So today that you can put, you know, the labels on it, the phenomenon, what's occurring, that makes a huge difference, doesn't it? But because before you were just, you thought you were going crazy, but really it's a pattern of abuse right. that people in power use, and right. you were experiencing it. Let me ask you this, Ted. I know we have interviewed for Whistleblower Network News and Whistleblower of the Week, veteran administration employees, and they're whistleblowers. And some of their stories are horrific. I mean, they've talked about the fact that they've blown the whistle, and then upper management in the VA reveals their identities under their program that they have, that the Office of Whistleblowing or whatever they have at the VA, they reveal their identities to the people they're blowing the whistle against. Is that still happening in the VA, or were you aware of that?
I don't know, because in my case, I was not an anonymous whistleblower. I had flashing neon lights on me right from the get-go. I mean, I was just being transparent. I didn't realize back then that, you know, that might have been a good option to take. Not that it would have mattered. But
were you aware through either anecdotal or anything else while you were working at the VA how hostile they were or are to whistleblowers? I mean,
no,
there was...
I had no idea. I'd never really heard about any whistleblower stories within the VA. You know, at that time, I had no idea that that kind of thing was going on.
So you charged into the fight. You were just doing the right thing. You were bringing to their attention something that was incredibly important and hurting the clients of the VA. So tell us what happened. Here you are, the good guy.
So the first 2 months the retaliation started, part of the silencing tactics, as I mentioned about the gaslighting, and then they basically told me I'm not welcome at the vet center, and if I were to come there, the police would be called, trying to make it look like I'm hostile and aggressive when I never had threatened anybody. So that was going on, and as that was ensuing, as I'm filling out, you know, different grievances for various federal agencies to look into this, like OSC and the OIG, which is, like, as I found out later, you know, like putting the fox in charge of the hen house, I got very depressed and very angry. And that first 2 months, around the February, March timeframe in 2018, I, you know, was very angry, depressed, sedentary, because I'm working on all these documents, you know, 10 hours a day to submit to these various agencies. And I ended up at the end of March of that year, having a submassive saddle pulmonary embolism that the doctors told me should have killed me. It's 100% mortality, that I shouldn't even be here. And so, you know, I recuperated from that, and I ended up having to have my own therapeutic intensive and to get me back on my feet and get my head straight so I could continue, you know, onward, you know, personally, and both with fighting this cause. But I'd have to admit, you know, there's a few times along the way I almost threw in the towel.
Yes. And that's why I'm so interested, Ted. I mean, I know you were a warrior in the military, but as a whistleblower, it takes a certain kind of person to pursue that path. I mean, it takes a tremendous amount of courage. And
well,
it sounds
me,
to me, you didn't have a crew behind you of other whistleblowers saying, good going, Ted, and here's what's happening, and trying to help you.
Right. And before my therapeutic intensive, around June of 2018 is when I was referred to Jackie Gierek of Whistleblowers of America and all the peer mentorship that goes on in her organization to help whistleblowers understand, you know.
And that helped.
It helped tremendously to understand, hey, look, this is a strategy they intentfully use. This is common. Mm-hmm. These are the things you need to be aware of. Here's suggestions for plans of actions you
Good.
Need to take. And we've got, you know, a group of people in the same situation that you know, we can all support each other. And that's kind of what helped me also to stay in the game beyond my therapeutic intensive.
Exactly. And this is hopefully where the whistleblower world is heading, where we can support one another, explain this phenomenon, which is just so egregious and so ugly. And so now you're...
I was going to say, in the National Whistleblower Center, you know, eventually that I found out about the following year in 2019, mm-hmm. I go to my first National Whistleblower Day and met some, you know, Siri Nelson and the executive director and some other people, and it was just another organization doing the same thing to support whistleblowers and hearing those stories at the end of July in 2019. It was very inspiring. And again, you know, helping me to stay the course, realizing, you know, that I'm not alone in this.
Good. I think that's so important, Ted. It's just critical for whistleblowers to realize that. I want to ask, you haven't mentioned an attorney. Did you secure an attorney? Because I know that can be financially devastating.
Yeah. That was a very unfortunate experience for me. I did seek counsel for my EEO process for the informal mediation that started that turned out to be a hoax because nobody chose on the other side to be there in person. It was over the phone. And again, it was part of their tactic. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't feel safe being in the same room with him.
Yes.
Kind of thing. You know, this whole narrative about, you know, he's a mentally unstable combat veteran. I mean, they didn't come out and directly say that, but just by the actions they took, that's what they were insinuating. And that was very obvious. And the lawyer I had was absolutely horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody that deals with these kinds of things, I was not really given full informed consent as I look back, and I was given some misinformation, quite frankly, up front. And it just did not go well. And because of the expense, it's just not something I could afford to do. And when I looked into who might do this pro bono, they didn't want to touch it because the government, you know, has deep pockets. So they can go on and on and on. The individual can't
forever.
They know that. Mm-hmm. And these firms, you know, can't take on those kinds of cases because in the end, they're going to end up losing tens of thousands of dollars, especially if the case isn't won. So
that's absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And you're describing a phenomenon, Ted, that a lot of us have gone through. My first attorney was an absolute bust. They wanted, you know, settle. Take $10,000, he said, and, you know. Let's just settle this. Well, and you have to dump those people right away. But did you eventually find an attorney who was there for you?
No, I never did. And so in my case, the EEO process through the Office of Resolution Management, ORM, didn't really go anywhere. I did appeal, go to the final phase, but I did that unrepresented and had a determination by the agency in the end, which ruled against me. And one of the issues I had, they said, oh, well, you didn't meet the 45-day deadline by 3 days. And so we can't rule on this because you didn't submit in accordance with the deadline. And where that might have gone, I don't know. So
exactly. Those are traps, Ted. Those are traps deliberately set up. There's a ton of whistleblowers.
And so what I would say to viewers is, you know, a couple things in the process, because I wrote a book about all of this called Broken Promises, Marine Combat Veteran Turns Whistleblower Exposing Compromised Mental Health Care, you know, at the Department of Veterans Affairs. And
yes.
Here it is. And it just got released about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And
yes,
it's here it is. And, you know, in there, I point out a number of things from my lessons learned. I didn't get in so much of the legal aspect, probably should have included that. But number one, when you take this on because of retaliation, you better find counsel. And if you can't, you know, try to find through National Whistleblower Center, Whistleblowers of America, and their contacts, find somebody that might be able to do it pro bono or on some sort of a sliding scale fee to make it affordable. That's number one, because otherwise you're going to fall into too many pitfalls or Jane, the traps that you refer to. But then the next two things is you better have all your ducks lined up, all the evidence, documents, emails, whatever it is, witnesses, you know, videos, recordings, whatever it is, because it has to be, you know, airtight. And then what's really important, two big factors of the several, and I'll just mention them real quickly, is self-care.
Yes.
And that's something I failed miserably in, obviously because of the embolism I referred to earlier, and critically, is building a network of support before you even launch. Get legal help and get backing from the National Whistleblower Center or an organization like Whistleblowers of America to really understand what's going on so you can develop an effective strategy. And those two things I did not do, and I'm very fortunate that things ended up as successfully as it did in my campaign, because the other thing I point out in that blueprint to be maximally effective and to have the most favorable outcome possible is you also have to have the media working in tandem with the political action that you instigate at the federal level through your congressional delegates at your home state. And that's what I did. And it turned out to work out favorably in my case, because Senator Tester, of the chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee, and my Senator Reed in Rhode Island, who's the chair of the Armed Forces Committee, actually had a federal investigation launched through the GAO that validated my allegations. And in the end of all this, going fast forward, just this past December, the Vets Center Improvement Act was passed into law, holding the VA accountable to restore and protect quality mental health care for veterans, as well as safeguard the well-being of the counselors who serve them in the system. So that was a huge win, with the focus now being ensuring that the VA complies with the legislation. So I had media things going on along
the
way.
Yes, you did. And you had a hand in that, Ted. You had a hand in that congressional behavior that went on. You were allowed to interface with them, the politicians, provide advice.
And they even, in the end, through my staffers here in D.C., through Senator Reed's office, I was able to actually provide my input to edit the bill where I thought it needed to be tightened up before it even went to the floor for a vote. So it was
incredible.
It was fabulous, you know, how that all worked out. But had the media not been involved in it at the national level, with the Military Times and NBC, for instance, they may not have paid as much attention. And that's why I say those two things really do have to work in tandem.
I am so happy you're bringing these points up, because they are so critically important. And we try to, you know, present these ideas, like at this last National Whistleblower Day, self-care, you know, getting the legal representation that you're going to need. I mean, you're just pointing out the media, utilizing the media. You're pointing out everything that is so critical to make your case as a whistleblower. And you are still in the whistleblowing world. You are committed, aren't you? It's just not your case.
Well, no,
which
it's
was
not
horrific.
My case. I mean, I've got support for mine, and my focus from here is to try to ensure the VA complies with the legislation through contacts I just made at the Whistleblowers of America conference in Washington this past week, where I had an opportunity to meet Senator Grassley, who's the strongest component of whistleblower protection, probably in the entire U.S. Congress. And actually was able to have a photo op with him too, with my new book, and gave an autographed copy thanking him, you know, for his support of whistleblowers. And in part with other staffers I met of Senator Tester and Senator Reed, gave them autographed copies of my book for them, you know, with a caveat to, you know, please ensure the VA complies with the legislation.
Yes.
That was, you know, part of my ploy in that, really, and meeting with staffers from both Veterans Affairs committees, also doing the same thing and making the rounds. And now what I'll be doing is contacting major veteran service organizations and getting to the legislative directors to also work things like that from their angle to hopefully get that kind of support to that end.
I just am so delighted you are so involved in the whistleblower community and you're spending your time and assets. Now, you do have a GoFundMe set up because this has been tough on you and your family financially. As all whistleblowers know, it's a tough road, but it really took a lot out of you financially, didn't it?
It did, because what ended up happening as part of the retaliation, if you can believe this, is 3.5 years after all this had started, a colleague of mine, a former colleague who had retired that I worked with at the vet center in Warwick, passed away. It was a pallbearer in her funeral. In accordance with her obituary, hey, drop off a donation at the vet center, you know, to be used by veterans receiving services there. And I do. My director, who was one of the main components, she wasn't even there that day. And she finds out the fact I stopped by the next day to drop off this donation. She filed a false police report with the VA police, who got the local municipality police involved to trespass me, which defamed my character, could prevent me from getting further employment should they do a background check. And that was completely unwarranted. So I'm out tens of thousands of dollars defending myself against that.
And you got it reversed.
And
you
got it. It got reversed. It
good
got
for you.
Because, again, I had my ducks lined up. I had witnesses, the counselors up there, you know, and then the VA police chief I went to see, you know, he gave me a cold shoulder, wouldn't give me access to a copy of the report under FOIA, claiming things were still under investigation when it never was. They never interviewed me. They never interviewed the counselors. Word for it completely. And the only reason she did not end up in court, according to my attorney, was because it never would have passed the summary stage, even though it met two of the major three requirements. She never quite accused me falsely of committing a crime.
Right.
And that then the deciding factor. And it was just absolutely horrific. But
it is amazing. It is amazing the vitriol that was just aimed at you. And, you know, it becomes almost personal, doesn't it? They kick you out of the tribe.
Right.
And then they want to throw rocks at you when you're outside the tent. You know what I mean?
Right.
They just will not let it go. And I've heard whistleblowers talk about years afterward, they're still, you know, trying to get at them.
I'd
either
like to comment on that, if I may, in terms of the impact. But, you know, understanding that the first comment I want to make is for me, because of the level of betrayal that took place here, as with other whistleblowers, for me personally, it was more traumatic than any combat experience.
I hear you, Ted.
A lot of people don't get, and they think, really? It's like, yeah, because of the level of betrayal. So visually, deeply personal, and that level of betrayal, like the Vietnam veterans coming back from Vietnam, only to be shunned and discriminated against the way they were, you know, really, that to a lot of them was more traumatic than being in Vietnam itself.
Yes.
And
the betrayal.
But as far as the impact goes, you know, National Whistleblowers Day here about a month ago in Washington, and then last week the Whistleblowers of America annual conference, hearing keynote speakers up there getting emotional, telling a story even after 10 or 20 years, and speaking with some of them one-on-one on the side, and how they continue to ruminate over and over, both of which are flags that this has not been processed. And as a therapist in this, I see a huge need for whistleblowers to get, like they do legal help, to get therapeutic help, and to kind of build a coalition of resources where whistleblowers can go to that's announced at the National Whistleblower Center, Whistleblowers of America. Hey, a list of people or resources where you can go to get this kind of help to process this stuff. And here's some self-care techniques that can be used to help you regulate and manage things, you know, short of, you know, dealing with the more deeply traumatic things that you might need to find a practitioner, you know, on this list that could be helpful in that regard. And I would like to see something move in that direction because it's badly needed.
Oh, I hear you, brother. Been there, done it. I hear you. And you're making just incredible sense here. And you're offering knowledge to other whistleblowers, which is critically important. And I totally agree with you. You see whistleblowers 10 years later that are still ruminating. Their sense of identity has been destroyed. And they're trying to find their way back. And there is life after whistleblowing. And you are proving that. You are proving that. And that's why I love having you on our program. You are proving that. Because you have been interviewed by the national media and you have got this book out. What are you planning to do in the future?
Well, what I'm doing, I've had like just in the last week, three other interviews besides this one. I have a book tour in Las Vegas coming up in October, a few more podcast interviews. So what I'm doing is the book itself is a major source to look at and the main record for the issues I bring up. In fact, the references are so massive, I couldn't include it in the book. So my website at www.vabreakingpromises.com is where you can go, where I have a references tab for all the documentation broken down chapter by chapter in the references tab in the menu bar of my website for transparency and credibility. And I also have a media tab with all my local national media interviews that people can review should they would want, and a contact tab for any kind of speaking engagements people would like me to do. They can contact me through that as well. But I'm using that in the book primarily to raise awareness, to inspire others to want to support this cause, especially with the focus now being ensuring the VA complies with the legislation.
Yes.
Supporting people know about the book, get the book, encourage others to do the same to that end primarily. And also why the book is very valuable from what I've been hearing from people is because the level of success I've had at leading to congressional legislation serves as a beacon of hope to whistleblowers that, hey, look, David can beat Goliath. Here it is. And then the blueprint I offer in the back of the book from Lessons Learned, some of which I described, a few of the 9 or 10 important elements in order to be maximally effective, to have the most favorable outcome possible, is a step-by-step considerations of things that whistleblowers need to consider in order to be successful and take care of themselves. And the last thing being, in my chapter 10, I also unveil, things about PTSD.
Yes.
And a lot of whistleblowers have PTSD.
Yes, they do.
Accounts are still in the system, but I go into treatment modalities and address the cutting edge interventions like emotional freedom techniques, thought field therapy, that are evidence-based, proven, cutting-edge interventions and treatment in dealing with trauma compared to conventional modalities. I reference the research in the book, and I call out the VA also in that chapter. How dare you not have these interventions fully accepted as evidence-based and have it offered in the VA as it should? It's a travesty that they have not. And I mentioned some websites where people can go to investigate, these things so that they can find the help they might need. Now, I didn't get into anywhere near the level of detail in that. It wasn't really appropriate for this book, but perhaps, there could be a sequel to this if need be, depending on about this other avenue that I'm going to go because of a need for whistleblowers to get that kind of help.
Oh, that just sounds magnificent. And I have to ask you, I just sit here over the last 25 years and watch the progression of whistleblowing and whistleblowers. And it's really amazing, especially in the last 5 years, how much fact-based evidence has come in and, just insight into the whistleblower, the people who retaliate. So it's really an incredible and exciting new field, and I'm glad you're maybe going to be doing a second book. But I want to ask you, what makes you have the ability to hang in there, to be that David to the Goliath, that you went through all this, you know, the physical, psychosocial, everything. What in your makeup has set you apart that has allowed you to do it?
Well, foremost is the fact that ever since I can remember, I've always had an extremely strong sense of fairness and justice. And whether it be me or somebody else, not being treated right or fairly and egregiously at times, it would just, I just could not stand by and let something like that happen. I've always had this strong sense I've got to stand up for justice and fairness. And for me, the motivating emotion behind that was anger. And especially the way they started treating me. And so gradually I was in a very deep and dark place. It was not good. And I'm not going to go into details about that. I address that in my book because that's the other value the book has, is I address very deeply and personally the tactics used against me, some of which I mentioned, and the impact it had was absolutely horrendous. The embolism is one thing, but the anger and rage I felt and how that affected me, and the fact that I was emotionally distancing from family members, not available to them, and you know, those kinds of things that going on, it was I was a bit of a recluse there for a while, so it had a huge impact. But going forward, so what happened is I took care of myself and went through that therapeutic intensive and got back on my feet, that anger gradually was not as intense, was not as frequent or as easily triggered. And so along the way, it transferred into constructive action. So it transitioned. There was a shift where the anger was not so much about resentment and bitterness as it was about constructive action to ensure these things get corrected, and kind of learning along the way to not really be taking it so personal. But it's not something you can do alone. You need the mentorship. You need self-care stuff and emotionally, like I went through a therapeutic intensive. There's things I did with emotional freedom techniques that I just referred to before, and that's kind of what helped me stay in the game.
Excellent advice, Ted. Just excellent advice. And I have to tell you, I'm right there with you. I'm just right there with you. I just am so glad that you're able to share your experience, to share, how you worked in the system, how you survived. I am so proud of you. I just really am. And you are going to be a major part of the whistleblowing world going forward. So do you have any last thoughts, Ted, you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, I think we've pretty much covered a lot of the important points, but just to sum up, two things I would like to reiterate is, again, the importance of my book, because it is the main record that addresses these issues to raise awareness. So you need to get the book. You need to encourage others to do the same, all because of the focus going forward to ensure the VA complies with the legislation, to contact congressional delegates to ensure that they do that. And the bill is H.R. 7776, section 5126, starting on page 819, which is the improvement of vet centers at the Department of Veterans Affairs. And that was basically passed as an amendment to the FY23 National Defense Authorization Act. That's what the HR 7776 is. And so that's vitally important that they comply with that, and getting the word out about it through the book, because that's it's the main source that does that. And then, of course, the websites I mentioned of where people can go to regulate in Chapter 10 all the trauma and irregularities that go along emotionally with this. There's places you can go that I mentioned that can help regulate that, where in the case of energypsych.org, which is the website for the Association for Comprehensive Energy Psychology, even has in their tab, their menu bar, they find a practitioner, you know, that you can find regionally closer to you should you want to pursue that kind of help. So I briefly, you know, mentioned that in chapter 10. So that's kind of important as well. And to stay the course, don't do it alone. Go to Whistleblowers of America, National Whistleblower Center, you know, to get recommendations for the kind of help that's important to stay the course, to, you know, not be caught short-sighted like I was when I first started out, like most whistleblowers do. And
yes.
So those are the main things that I would say, and how we've got to stick together and take care of ourselves and each other.
Excellent, excellent advice and fine words. And I thank you, Ted. You are a credit to the whistleblowing world, and I wish you much luck. I look forward to reviewing your book for Whistleblower Network News. It sounds like a winner.
Well, thank you, Jane. I really appreciate that, and I'm glad that I've been here with you today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Sharon Watkins. For better or worse, I am known as the Enron whistleblower, and I certainly have a heart for those going through anything that can be called blowing the whistle or speaking truth to power. I am here today to encourage every one of you to participate in making National Whistleblower Day permanent. You can do this by going to www.whistleblowersblog.org and joining notable whistleblowers like Jane Turner, Bunny Greenhouse, Aaron Restwick, Fred Whitehurst, and myself in taking action. We are urging our representatives, and you can too, urge your representatives and President Biden to sign an executive order recognizing whistleblowers on a permanent National Whistleblower Day. Again, that's www.whistleblowersblog.org. Together we can make this happen. Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and please don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe. If you want to read more whistleblower stories, go to www.whistleblowersblog.org. Music by Rachel Kilgore. Editing and booking by Anissa Shake and Victoria Thompson. And a special thanks to our sponsors, Whistleblower Network News. I think you'll find that it's just as hard to stand up tall as it was when you were small. The truth is hard.